Thank you very much, John, for an eloquent and inspiring address. We have a response panel tonight. We're very privileged to have two people. We originally had a third panelist scheduled, Ruth Conant of Progressive Magazine, but she had to conflict it off, and she had to cancel her engagement with us.
Although, can I just tell you that Mitch Miller would honor both, she would honor a conflict, right?
Yes.
And Ruth is down in Chicago addressing the Democratic Socialists of America, which I think Mitch would also think of as an honorable one.
So, but we were pleased that she initially was able to agree. We also have Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. Many of you may know, I hope you are aware, that she was instrumental in that capacity in exposing the machinations of the American Legislative Exchange Council, better known as ALEC. She has previously served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice in Washington, and also in senior staff positions in the Congress and the Judicial Branch of the federal government. You heard John speak about how corporations, special interests, are entering the field of politics and trying to take it over and use it for their own purposes. What Lisa and the Center for Media and Democracy have done with respect to ALEC helps to explain how that is being done. How, with model legislation, the American Legislative Exchange Council is filtering out to all states some of what we have in this state. Voter ID law, for example, portions of the collective bargaining bill, some others perhaps. There were model bills submitted by ALEC to people in Wisconsin who introduced it and made it become law. They're doing this in all 50 states. The Koch Brothers Exposed film, which was shown last night and tonight, does a very good job of explaining that. How they're taking over the laboratories and democracies in the various states. So, our main job tonight is to respond to John's remarks, but you may also help to make that connection as well. We also have Mary Bell, the president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, representing almost 100,000 teachers here in the state. She's been an educator for a long time, 33 years. Taught in Cardin, Wisconsin Rapids, and Rhineland directly. And people that she works for, teachers and educators, are among those who have been most affected by the legislation that caused the uprising last year and the ongoing events. So we'll hear first from Lisa and then from Mary. Then we'll have questions and answers after. Maybe some back and forth, but you're welcome to have a discussion among the three. And after that, we will have questions and answers in the time of the meeting.
Thank you so much, Fred. It's a joy to be invited to this esteemed meeting. And really, I am so grateful for the invitation to be here and to be here with you this evening. Can you hear me all right? It's actually really hard to respond to John. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of going after him. It's a tour de force, really. The history, the politics, the strategy. I learn something every single time I listen to John Nichols, and it's truly an honor to be on this panel with you. And Mary Bell, really, I'm here because I had amazing teachers. I went to public schools. My teachers were paid very little relative to other people in the community, and they looked out for me. They made the world of difference in my life. They made me believe that there were things that were possible that I couldn't even imagine. To go from being a child in a very impoverished home to being Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the United States, in Washington and Chief Nominations Counsel for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, and the Chief Deputy Chief of the U.S. Court System for Article III Judges, impossible feats in a society that would not invest in public education. My career is really in no small measure due to the teachers. So I honor that. Now, I should say that I went to the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse. I didn't go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I fell in love with Don Weber, who's up there, and he was going to La Crosse, and you know, the heart just does what the heart wants. And so I was, I am a UWL graduate, and I'm honored to be here this evening to respond to, I suppose, really the question of the night, which is, you know, what's next? And I think John articulated a really powerful vision, a long-term vision, really, of what's next. And so perhaps I think the best thing I could do would be to give you a snapshot of one of the battles we're fighting right now, and where that battle is headed. And so, as John mentioned, my organization, the Center for Media and Democracy, which was founded here in Madison in 1993 by John Stauber, has taken a lead, in essence, in helping to expose the American Legislative Exchange Council. Now, we stand on great shoulders. So many people, like John and others, have been working to try to expose ALEC for many years. And there are numerous reports out there about ALEC, about, you know, concerns about what they were up to, bills that seem to be ALEC bills or were actually credited as ALEC bills, people who seem to be doing the bidding of these, you know, foreign corporations. But we think that we contributed significantly to that effort when a whistleblower contacted me and also contacted the nation and said that they had over 800 bills that were a part of the ALEC library. What does it mean to be a bill in the ALEC library? It's not a library like the libraries around here. It's a library of the templates to rework our rights in every area of the law. When I looked at the file that I had been given, I, who had been in Washington, who had been fighting a number of battles to try to reform the Patriot Act, to fight the bad George W. Bush judicial nominees, to try to protect the court system, I had no idea that there was this shadowy organization named ALEC that was so extraordinarily influential and had devoted such a breadth and depth and duration of resources to rewriting our rights at the state level and really also at the federal level. The ALEC echo is in numerous bills, both at the state level and the federal level. And so as Mary Batari and I started poring over those bills and I was determined to make them public, what we discovered was more than just the bills. What we discovered was that how ALEC operates, quite frankly, is deeply offensive to the notion of democracy and sort of deeply indicative of the sickness that plagues our democracy. I say that because I was a lobbyist for the American Civil Liberties Union after my government jobs for a couple years. I was working to help reform the Patriot Act. We actually ended up with a filibuster of the Patriot Act in 2005. People said it was unheard of. You could never filibuster national security legislation. I said if the legislation was bad, we ought to try, and we did, and we put together a filibuster, and then ultimately we got squeezed by the Bush administration and it fell apart in the wake of warrantless wiretapping, which we then fought to withdraw and then ended up losing on that battle because AT&T poured so much money into the lobbying. But I was a lobbyist for the ACLU, and I'll tell you what, I never, not once, walked into a legislative meeting and had a legislator say to me, here's the plan. I get a vote, and you get a vote, and we're equals. But that's what ALEC does. I mean, it's actually astonishing to me to behold this. So as we looked through the documents, one of the documents we got was most intriguing. It said, ALEC is a unique organization. How is it unique? It provides the public sector and the private sector, meaning the elected officials and the corporate representatives, an equal voice and vote. And we said, what does that mean, an equal voice and vote? Don't corporations already have an enormous voice in our politics, in our democracy? They are influencing so many things. They've got leagues of lobbyists who are working to try to change things. They've got tons of PACs. They're spending money here and there. Their CEOs are funding campaigns. What more could the corporations possibly want? Apparently, they want a vote, too. A vote.
And so as we looked through the ALEC bills, what we learned was that in fact how ALEC operates is that in task force meetings, corporations, corporate lobbyists, are voting as equals with your elected representatives, with our elected representatives. Behind closed doors, no press is present, no public is present, and they're voting on the template to change the rights of teachers, to change your rights if your wife is killed by a defective drug, to change tax policy, to change environmental policy so that we can't pursue the bad actors and who are polluting our rivers and damaging the air we breathe. ALEC has the audacity to set up an arrangement in which corporations don't just have the voices that they have through money already, through the terrible decision of Buckley v. Valeo from the 1970s that has damaged, devastated our democratic process, enhanced by the terrible decision of Five Guys on the Supreme Court and Citizens United. That's not enough for them. They want to vote. So the other part of the equation is politicians, including elected representatives in this state, who debase themselves, who would debase the sacred trust that they've been given by being elected to represent you, to go off to a secret closed-door meeting at a resort in Arizona or New Orleans or Salt Lake City this August, and actually vote behind closed doors as an equal with an unelected corporate lobbyist from a global corporation who really has a primary interest in profit and not an interest in the constituents of Wisconsin or any other state. That's shocking to me. Shocking to me. And I'll tell you what, we are a nonpartisan organization. ALEC described itself as a nonpartisan organization. That's actually a bit of a misnomer since 103 out of 104 of its leaders are Republicans at the last time we checked. But if it turned out that Nancy Pelosi had said, to me, hey Lisa, you give an equal vote to me as a representative of the ACLU, there would be hearings on Congress until people were in jail. In jail. Because it would be wrong to give an equal voice to me as a lobbyist of an organization or of a corporation to an elected official, elected to represent the people in this country. But that's what ALEC does. But it's more than that. Once those bills become the templates in all these areas to change our rights if someone is injured, our rights in education, our rights as laborers, as workers, the higher education system, health and human services, to privatize Social Security, to privatize Medicaid, to oppose healthcare reform, on and on and on. After all that, those templates then are basically charged to the leaders of the ALEC delegation in the state. They have a duty under ALEC's published bylaws to take those bills and get them introduced in the state house. And they have a duty under ALEC's bylaws to get those bills made into law. In other words, legally binding on the rest of us. Who are the leaders in Wisconsin? 2 years ago, it was Senator Scott Fitzgerald and Mike Hipsch. They were the ALEC co-chairs for the state of Wisconsin. They were tasked with the duty of getting the ALEC agenda made into law as of the end of 2010. Last year, Mike went over to the, I don't know him, Mike. Went over to the Department of Administration, and Scott Fitzgerald became notorious in other ways. Soon Robin Voss and Scott Suter became the ALEC co-chairs for the state of Wisconsin. They are the ALEC co-chairs of the state of Wisconsin. What ALEC does is it vests in some of the most powerful leaders in the state houses across the country this duty to push this agenda forward. And they do. And they do. Now ALEC says, don't worry, this is just a model legislation. It goes back to the state house. It's subject to full debate and vote. Real people, you know, real legislators vote. There's a democratic process. We're not the end of the process. Well, that's a nice idea, but what we've seen in practice, and what we certainly saw in Wisconsin, was a sham of a legislative process in which bills were put forward with hardly any notice to fellow legislators, let alone to citizens, of what was afoot. Hearings were shortened and closed and gaveled down before people could be heard. Members who were pushing this agenda sat with their arms crossed, refusing to listen to the voices. The leader of the state, Scott Walker, an ALEC alumni, had the audacity to basically suggest that that everyone or most people were brought in and bussed in from out of state to protest the policies. They weren't listening. And in many of the bills, if you look at some of the key provisions, not a comma was changed. And why would it be changed? It was already pre-approved by corporations. You know, they're not there on the floor to change it again. Why would they let you change it through your elected representative? Why would they care about the democratic process or the minority party? Because when I see what happened in Wisconsin, and I moved here because Wisconsin wasn't Mississippi. When I made the decision to take this job, I took it because I knew from going to school in La Crosse and from being in Madison that this was a great state that I wanted to make my home. And because it wasn't Mississippi, because it was Wisconsin, but to come to this state and figure out that this was what was afoot was astonishing to me. And to see the utter disregard for the democratic will, for people expressing the harm, the hurt of the austerity agenda that was being crammed down our throats, to see the bills masquerading as jobs bills, like the first bill Walker signed into law on so-called tort reform, to see that happening and to see our legislators not acting like legislators the way you traditionally think of politics as the art of compromise or the art of negotiation, to see politics as basically corporate power writ large, like a government takeover, like a corporate takeover of the government, in which a party comes in and they don't care about the consequences for the future. They have power, they're gonna exercise it, and they're gonna basically retool all the levers to make sure that they get what they want and they don't have to compromise. Compromise is seen as an evil. It was stunning to behold. So we have a lot, that we're contending with, I should say. And I should wrap up here before I go on and on and on. Except for to say that we have Alec on the run. And that's in no small part. Due to the incredible efforts and the incredible willpower of people standing up in this state in February, in March, and saying no to this agenda. And saying, this seems like an Alec agenda. And connecting this to the Koch brothers, who are major, major longtime supporters of Alec. They got the highest award of Alec. Their lobbyist has been the chairman of the board of Alec. They've spent enormous amounts of money, not relative to them, but to me, to funding Alec. They are on key committees of Alec, including the committees that have done all sorts of damage to our policies. The people of Wisconsin stood up and stood up against this agenda, and that helped provoke other people in Ohio to stand up against the Alec agenda, which resulted in the whistleblower coming forward with the bills that we made public. And with the effort to make those bills public, we worked tremendously hard to try to tell this story in media across the country, to have those bills be a resource for reporters and citizens and to grow knowledge. And then when the terrible shooting of Trayvon Martin occurred and it turned out that people were citing an obscure law so that his shooter wouldn't be arrested or prosecuted, I knew that that was an Alec bill. And we worked to document that and make sure that the media knew that that was an Alec bill. To know that that bill was conceived of by the NRA, was put forward in the arms of two empty suits in the Florida legislature who carried forward the NRA's agenda, that it was signed into law with the NRA lobbyist hovering over the shoulder of Jeb Bush, that lobbyist would travel to Texas a few months later to Grapevine, Texas, to an Alec meeting, in a closed door meeting, and push that bill as a model template for states across the country, that Walmart would be the co-chair of that task force meeting. Walmart, the largest seller of long guns, the biggest seller of ammunition in this country, was the chairman, co-chairman of the task force where that bill was ratified as a model for the nation. The NRA reported back that it was enthusiastically embraced and unanimously supported by the corporate lobbyists, special interest groups, and politicians who were there, that it would be embraced by the Alec board, that it would make its way across the country to 24 states nearly identically in another 10 states, in part including Wisconsin last year. Same with voter ID or voter suppression bills that basically make it hard for you to use your ID and your utility bill to actually vote because you are who you are and here's proof of where you live. It doesn't count under the new Wisconsin law. So that Trayvon Martin story, putting a name and a face, in essence a victim, a real terrible tragedy, to this Alec policy, what can happen when these policies are pushed through that aren't sought by the people, but are sought by special interest groups to advance their own interests, to see that in a real flesh and blood way, opened up a lot of people's eyes to what Alec was up to, and since then we've had a tremendous breakthrough in public awareness. And to date, over a dozen corporations have left Alec, have fled Alec, including McDonald's, Kraft Foods, Taco Bell, Coca-Cola, who we started targeting last July when we launched Alec Expose. To see other corporations calling our office, speaking to Mary Vitari and me, saying, hey, we used to be part of Alec, but please could you stop listing us because we don't want to be associated with Alec, has been a bit bewildering to behold. To have 24 legislators across the country, including Republicans and Democrats, leave Alec in the past week. Advertising on its site that it needs more money because apparently it's losing funds on a daily basis. Alec is on the run, but I kid you not, while that is an enormous feat, it's by no means sufficient. Because as John says, that money will pop up in other places, it will find another vehicle. And so this really is about a dialogue about what our country is about, what we want, what we need, and our future. That Alec agenda is Grover Norquist's agenda on taxes. It is ATR, American Tax Reform, is part of Alec, a long-standing part of Alec. They have pushed that agenda through Alec and the federal government. The agenda to destroy our public school system and push public schools out of the picture for private schools through the sort of camel's nose under the tent of charter schools, that is the Alec agenda, led by an online school company as the current co-chair of the Alec Education Task Force. Over and over again, if you look at these task forces, you see the financial interests. As John said, in quoting the great Robert La Follette, the cloak of these serfs, the feudal system of these corporate lords doing their bidding, and there are very precious few people standing against them. But I think that that number is growing, and Wisconsin has stood up and said that that number is growing and growing stronger. So
we have a lot to do. And that's
Lisa. Our final perspective is from Maribel, who we previously introduced, but I heard her speak a number of times at the state capitol, and she was very eloquent, and we haven't discussed what she's going to say, but she may be able to give us more perspective on how it all is.
There's so much in the first two presentations, and you have all been very patient, so I will try and be brief and succinct. I'm a junior high school teacher. I deal with 12-year-olds. You can't talk too long. You lost them if you do. But there are a couple of points in what John had to say and then what was followed that I want to make sure are woven into the text of my member's story. Because I represent public school teachers and education support professionals who work in the classrooms with children every day, school custodians, and technical college instructors. When John talked about the fact that this is a long-term movement, that it is not about a recall election, he's absolutely right. It is about so much more than that. It is what happened last winter, what we felt since then, the agenda that began so long ago with the influence of corporate money, is to make people feel small and corporations large. That's what's happened. It's the division that's been driven between people and public institutions. That we're supposed to believe that public school teachers in the state of Wisconsin left their classrooms last winter because of pension and healthcare concessions. They did not. It was the fate of their profession that turned them out. It was an offense against everything they believed had been a contract between their students, their communities, their profession, and state government. That was nothing that Scott Walker campaigned on. It was not about a simple election. And they want to define this recall as something small and petty and vindictive, those of us that were there and those of us who have explained to our friends and our neighbors and our family, it is not. It's not about that. My family comes from central Wisconsin. I was born and raised here. My grandfather, great-grandfather's family came here because they were starving in Ireland, and they settled in central Wisconsin on some of the poorest farmland they could find. But they owned that land, and within 5 years, he'd formed a school board and a local school. Because what he did value more than that, more than making a fortune, which he never did, was public education for his children. And they hired a teacher, paid her poorly, but they hired a teacher. And they made sure that their children were educated and that they were able to go to a high school, a public high school. I was raised in Adams County, which at the time I was there was the second poorest county in this state. But I received a quality, free public education because that was a Wisconsin value. And I was able to come to this institution twice for a bachelor's and a master's degree and benefit from what Wisconsin citizens said was important to them. One of the most troubling pieces of research I read in the last couple of weeks was a research piece about the connection between Wisconsin citizens and the Wisconsin idea. A fracturing of the connection that our citizens have with what has been a constant contract between our education system and our citizenry. When they have made the University of Wisconsin seem small, we have to stand up and do something about that. That's not what this institution has ever been about. It has offered opportunity to generation after generation, and we need to stand for that. What's happened in the last couple of weeks, John referred to in terms of rulemaking, I have to talk about that because it is a very complex idea, but it comes down to a very simple thing. The governor, through his authoritarian power of rulemaking, which was another of the major reasons we were out last winter, who on earth could believe the legislature would cede their rulemaking authority to one individual in an executive position to do anything he wanted? That's what's happened with the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission rules this last week. They promulgated a set of rules and he rewrote them. He rewrote them to say not just that pension and health care concessions were part of Act 10, not just that the elimination of all real virtual collective bargaining other than a cost of living increase were eliminated with Act 10 for public employees, but that the very foundation, the vague term in Act 10, base wages, could be manipulated by any district that so chose to take the most experienced and the best educated of their teaching staff and roll them back to a beginning teacher's wage. And they have nothing to say about it, other than what our movement actually brings us, which is back together. When we were together in February and in March, and when we were together in November and in December and January on those cold corners, we didn't feel small. They couldn't fractionalize and marginalize our concerns. They were about real kids. They were about my neighbors. They were about healthcare. They were about nurses. They were about all kinds of public employees that have real faces and real names to me. When you talk about ALEC's legislation, Act 10 certainly is a part of that. But my favorite story about the kind of mindless introduction of Act 10 or ALEC legislation was the Florida legislator who literally introduced the bill complete with the name American Legislative Exchange right in the text of the bill, like it wasn't the state of Florida she was working for. She withdrew the bill very quickly when someone mentioned it to her, but it's still on the record. it's really clear who these people are. But I absolutely agree that wherever that money is, even if it gets pulled from ALEC, it will pop up somewhere else. This is not a new phenomenon. We've been fighting this for as long as I've been actively looking at. The money that is used against public education as only one factor, one sector of the public institutions that we value so greatly. It is a risk for the state of Wisconsin, but it's a challenge we are up to, and we are going to do this because it isn't about a single election. It's about who controls our government, who controls our lives, and a quality of life, regardless of whether you live on the North Shore of Milwaukee or the South Shore of Lake Superior. Everyone deserves a high quality of education. Everyone deserves a quality of living, healthcare, a clean environment, and a government you can trust. That's what's at stake. Thank you.
How we'll handle this is we'll pass this microphone among the three panelists, John, Michael, and Roger. And we'll ask them to repeat your question if it's not loud enough to be heard.
Here, make it louder.
And you can just ask questions directly to the panelists so that we'll go more.
Let's start with our young man. Say it loud so they can all hear you.
I'm an eighth grader at Marshall Middle School in Janesville, and we're doing a U.S. history segment right now. We're learning about Robert La Follette, and also there's a guy named William S. Uren. He was part of the progressivism movement, and he had three basic reforms: initiative, referendum, and recall. Mm-hmm. The one that I'm most concerned about is referendum with ALEC. Referendum is running the law by the people. And we're, as Lisa was talking about, ALEC's going to go away in a closed door area and vote upon it without showing it to people first. And that kind of goes against it. So I was wondering what happened to the referendum.
Let me take a piece of that quickly, and then Lisa may have something to add. We're in actually a really remarkable moment right now, because we are seeing 100 years on the protections that ALEC put in play, or that I got ALEC on the brain, I'm sorry. We've seen the protections that the progressives put in place 100 years ago. Put to use. And you know, the only real reference point for this is like the Lord of the Rings movie. Or something like that. Where somebody, actually it's women's doing something. Is it not on? How about that? Better. Is it better here?
Yeah.
All right, there you go. We're seeing protections that were put in place 100 years ago come into use. And the reference point is the Lord of the Rings films, right? Where somebody plants something, you know, 100 years before that will be found at a critical moment, found when it is needed. And initiative, referendum, and recall, IRR, was such a central part of Robert M. La Follette's premises that he campaigned on it. They actually made it the front page of his campaign materials when he would run for governor and for the U.S. Senate. Now here's a guy running to be in a position of power. He is running to be the executive or the legislator, but he is saying, do not trust me. Do not believe that I should have the full authority. You have to have vehicles by which you can overturn what I do. And if I go to such an extreme that I am a threat to the state, you have to be able to turn me out of office, not at the next election, but at the next possible moment. And this is a really big deal because in Wisconsin, interestingly enough, we didn't ever succeed in implementing the whole of IRR. We did implement recall. And I am really glad of that, because I think we're going to put it to very, very good use in short order. But we have not implemented referendum. in the ways that other states use it, and we haven't implemented initiative in the ways that other states use it. Had we done so, this is a very, just a subtle reality, had we done so, we could have last year done what Ohio did. And this is such a big deal. Ohio has the most wonderful political tool on its books that I know. It's even better than recall. And it is the veto referendum. What it means is that when a state passes a law that the great mass of people object to, if they go out and collect a substantial number of signatures, in Ohio, 12% of the electorate in the last election, they can, as soon as they file those petitions and they're certified, it's a fascinating thing. Wonderful, we had a similar thing on recall here. The second that they're filed, the law is put on hold. It cannot be implemented. Now, if we had that on recall, the second the recall was filed, Scott Walker couldn't have governed anymore. But the law is put on hold until the people get to weigh in. And in Ohio, when they put their collective bargaining law, very similar to ours, on the ballot last November, 61% of the people of Ohio voted to protect the collective bargaining rights of public employees. The other thing I would suggest to you is that as we go through this recall process, I would like to see Scott Walker recalled. I'd like to see Rebecca Clayfish recalled, and I really would like to see Lori Compass get rid of Scott Fitzgerald. But I also hope that as we get a new government in Wisconsin, we do not merely talk about economic issues, but we also talk about structural reforms that will allow us to have these powers that we lack at this point. And the one I would love to get in Wisconsin is a veto referendum so that we don't have to go through the kind of mess that we've just gone through for the last year and a half.
So just on Alec, just to clarify for folks, when the Alec members vote on these bills, they don't become law in that committee. But Wisconsin actually has an interpretation on the books about what's known as a walking caucus, in essence, that you can't just, you know, have a secret meeting at the bar down the street and, you know, really decide some of these major things without having the press or public present. And so there's, you know, some concern that what's happening in Alec is sort of a walking caucus. But in fact, they come back to the State House and have the appearance, in essence, of a Democratic input, sometimes with very little notice and with just a ratification of that bill through the majority of Alec members. The recall thing, I would just say, I have become such a huge fan of Robert La Follette. John has completely convinced me. I can't believe how little I knew about this great, great man. But I have to say that looking at the recall process just from the outside, from a sort of political science perspective, for me, I would like a modification on it if we're going to talk about reform, which would be, I actually am not sure that the governor does that much unless they're doing some harm. And I would like to see a recall process in which you have an up or down vote on that person. They're out. And then you have a new election with new people running versus having it be simultaneously with another election. I think it would be an improvement in the process, quite frankly, if in a sort of quasi-parliamentary system with a recall, you had an up or down vote on the governor, period. And then that was that. And then you would have a new election with new part, you know, new representatives. But that's just on my wish list. I also have other wish lists. But I think, Mary, did you want to jump in, or no?
Yeah, actually.
So that's just my question. So just to clarify, up or down, and then we'll deal with the rest later.
Yeah.
The problem is, who's the governor after he's recalled?
There's just a moment in which there isn't a governor.
Wait.
No, but, well, no, I'm not saying Kim Lynch, I'm saying whatever is recalled, whether I don't think legal lieutenant governors either in general, but that's a whole different topic.
And I think that in large measure, the other addition that I would add on that deals with the whole influence of corporate money, because when the recall process was envisioned, no one envisioned that from the time a recall petition would be filed until a recall petition would be certified, the incumbent would be able to raise unlimited amounts of money. Unlimited amounts of money.
That's a fix for that one, I can say.
It's a huge fix. It's a huge fix. And when John talked about people in other states who have, you know, come up to him and said, I just want to talk about Wisconsin, I will tell you that the most remarkable part for me is that it's not the New Yorks and the Pennsylvanias and the Californias that want to talk about it. It's Utah. It's Mississippi. It's Alabama. They're saying, you got to do this. You have to do this. It's our only
I mean, wait, it's a complicated thing of so many good, wise people. Why don't take our women straight up here?
Yeah, is there
a... You say it as loud as you can.
Is there an ALEC agenda with the judiciary? Because you look in Wisconsin at Annette Ziegler, Gableman, Prosser, and the other, the fourth one.
Yeah, there absolutely is an ALEC agenda. It's fascinating that the ALEC worms its way into all sorts of judicial issues. And one of the things is they're very interested in how judges are elected. They're very interested in how judicial campaigns are financed. But the most important thing, the thing that I think is fascinating, is the extent to which they want to take power away from judges. And we don't think of it this way. But one of the things that ALEC really wants to do is tell judges what they can and cannot decide. So they do tort reform. They want to take away the ability of a judge or a jury to say, you can't do that, or you're going to be fined for that, you're going to be required to pay a penalty. They want to take away the standard ground law, the Castle Doctrine law, takes away the ability of police and prosecutors and judges to hold someone to account for shooting someone. And most importantly, where they really want to take away the authority of the judiciary to check and balance the power of the rest of government is in the area of deciding on regulations, deciding on laws. And they, again and again, and I worked, this is the stuff I wrote for The Nation, the extent to which they want to narrowly define anyone who can check and balance a law that they have passed is absolutely astounding. They love a thing called preemption. They literally want to preempt the ability of other levels of government to do things. And so one of Alec's biggest things is to pass a law and then make it impossible for local government, school boards, or the courts to mitigate against it. And so they do have, there's definitely an agenda that Lisa may have something to add.
Right, I mean, I think John's precisely right about the way Alec attempts to take away the power of judges. And in many ways, that's actually really about taking away another check, which is really the jury system. One of the most astonishing bills that they push as part of their so-called jobs agenda is a bill that would say that you cannot sue if your child or your wife or your father is killed by a defective drug. If the drug is FDA approved, you would be barred from suing if your loved one dies, even as the drug is recalled in the wake of deaths across the country or limitations on your life due to another defect that basically makes it reduces your lifespan. You could not sue. You could not sue because the FDA had approved it, and a governmental body that has been, so riddled with corporate influence that so many drugs have been approved that have been recalled. That bill was introduced in Wisconsin by ALEC legislators just last year, and they wanted to make it worse than ALEC's bill. They wanted to include medical devices like heart stents and hip replacements. Johnson & Johnson is a major corporation and corporate funder of ALEC. They've had numerous drug recalls. They are facing lawsuits for failed heart stents and for hip joints that actually don't just fail, but they hurt the soft tissue that makes, which would render people disabled in the long term as a result of getting this surgery in the first place. And so these ALEC buddies decided to push this bill forward Wisconsin. It didn't make it through
yet,
but it's part of the agenda. The very idea that a jury of your peers should not be able to hold a company like Johnson & Johnson accountable for a defective drug or product that they recalled, and to say that the judge can't overturn it, that this is the law of the land, and that a jury can't find damages for you and for your loved one if someone dies as a result of a defective drug, this is their agenda. And so they are determined to basically put the power in the hands of the legislators that they have the most influence over and take it out of the hands of the judges and the juries. And, as John said, they are determined to preempt the power of local governments to pass their own laws that go against what the state wants, whether it's sick leave in Milwaukee, or whether it's an environmental provision out in a county to say that we don't want CAFOs in our backyard, or we don't want a nuclear power plant in our backyard. They are determined to work every single lever of government to make it impossible for us to have the kind of democratic influence that we have a rightful, you know, that we have a right to as American citizens.
Yes, right behind you.
Good evening. We hear about 1%, we hear about 99%, 50%. I want to talk about 59%. 59%, and sometimes it's 60, and 61, 62, 65. I've seen it as high as 67%. I've never seen it lower than 59%. I was not in the Capitol on February 13th, February 14th of last year, but shortly after that, I started going to the Capitol. And it was always, I started looking around. I saw something that I thought was strange. I began estimating, and other meetings I'd go to, I began counting, and it always was above 59%. And I'm talking about the rallies, I'm talking about public hearings, I'm talking about the campaign against Justice Prosser, I'm talking about the petitions for the state Senate recall last summer, I'm talking about the campaigns, I'm talking about the organization last fall when we began the recall, I'm talking about the recall itself. I went so far as to actually do a scientific sample of the signatures in one of the state Senate races. 59% of the circulators were women. 61% of the signers were women. And that 59%, everything I saw last year, 59 to 65% women. This movement has been carried on the backs of women, and no one seems to be aware of it.
I think you're somewhere. Very good. We knew you were going somewhere, Brian. It's not very obvious.
It has not escaped my attention.
Mic up.
Yes, I will. The fact that many of the public employees that Scott Walker decided to target with Act 10, by profession, 75% female. Nurses. A lot of those folks who work in state government, females in those professions. It has not escaped my attention that it is, but it is also those people who, when you do a public poll, respond how deeply they care about their community schools, how deeply they care about the quality of health services that are provided. And quite honestly, from personal experience, I can tell you the people who are actually providing care to elderly parents and to disabled children. It's going to be women. I'm from, I know you'll be shocked, a strong matriarchal Irish family. It doesn't surprise me that women are the ones who said, enough, we won't take it. But I also know from family with a lot of very strong uncles in it that it is going to be the citizens of Wisconsin as a total, but women as a strong driver that's going to change this. That's what I hope for.
Before I take Charlie's question, there's a subtlety on this as well. Our friend actually raises one of the more complex aspects of what's going on right now. The governor has decided that he wants to be reelected with a guy vote. And this is a guy vote, a male vote. This is a very big deal. It's a fascinating thing. People will say to me, well, why would Scott Walker sign a bill getting rid of our pay equity protections in Wisconsin right before election? That offends so many people. Why would he do it? Why would he sign bills right going into the electoral process in the midst of the recall, taking away reproductive rights protections? Why would he fly to St. Louis and appear at the NRA convention and accept their highest honor? You know, right in the midst of this, these are all controversial moves. Why would he do this now? And the fact is that Scott Walker's a lot, he may not be smart on everything, but he's very smart on polls. He has looked at the polls. He knows full well that he cannot get reelected if women are dominant force voting. This is a very big deal, because the gender gap is huge already and getting bigger. He has made a choice to toss women off and to go, frankly say, I want to max my guy vote. And it's a very fascinating phenomenon that's playing out. It doesn't mean he doesn't want women's votes, but he wants the votes of women who aren't going to vote for women's issues. He wants the votes of women who made their commitment. I'm a right to life. I'm committed to traditional values. I'm not going there. And so it is a fascinating political strategy. I've actually been spending a lot of time on this, and because it's distinct. It is an unsettling prospect. Because we've always seen it on the other way. We've said, well, the gender gap is a very cool thing. You know, we guys can screw stuff up and women will fix it. Right? They'll get us over the level. But I have absolute faith that Scott Walker is playing the gender gap, and he's playing it to max out a male vote because he's got such a bad ceiling for him on women voting. And we're going to watch that play out, because it now puts a huge new responsibility on women. There is no way that Scott Walker gets recalled and removed from office if we have even a standard gender gap. I hate to say it, I've looked at all the polls. The only way that Scott Walker gets recalled and removed from office is if women take very, very seriously the fact that this governor has decided to toss them under the bus, and if the men who love women and care about women choose to stand at their side and to vote to get rid of a governor who would play that kind of politics.
Charlie, we have time for about one more question.
All right, a quick one, Charlie.
A little poetic license. I sometimes really think we would be nicer to our brothers if more presidents and kings than I would have governors were mothers.
Yeah, America. Charlie Upbaugh. It figures in my book on socialism, and it figures in my book on the Wisconsin Uprising, because I never started anything without Charlie Upbaugh. That's it. Let's grab one. We're going to grab this one woman right here and then circle up.
My question is probably more for Mary. As a former guidance counselor many years ago and a great believer in the public school systems and what they've done for my child with my disability, I get so angry when what I see is disrespect, just such a fundamental disrespect for the critical job teachers do. But what I'd like from you are answers to the kind of things you hear about, we've got so many other ways we can educate kids these days. There's online, there's charter schools, homeschooling. It doesn't just have to be public schools anymore, which I'm so committed to, but I want to have more answers for that kind of thing.
It doesn't have to be public schools. Well, the public schools are the only institution that absolutely take and are obligated to educate every child. Every child. Now, we don't always reach that lofty goal, and I'm telling you, it is something that I was working exceedingly hard to try and remedy with my organization and my professional union. Before I had to fight for the very existence of public education. I've been a little distracted, but we'll get back to it. And we do continue that agenda even so. But what our experiment with voucher schools in Milwaukee has shown us over the last 20 years is that educating children in poverty is very difficult, and they don't do any better than the public schools, although they drain enough funding to be the second largest public school system in the state, the voucher schools in Milwaukee. That's a fact most people don't know. But it's a huge drain to maintain two systems of public education and say you're doing something when you've done nothing to change the real problem. It's poverty. It's a huge social issue we have to deal with. Charter schools, until last summer, Wisconsin's charter school law was a model for the nation. Because they were, in large measure, instrumentality charter schools, responsible to elected school boards, and they served specific functions district by district around the state. And they addressed some of our exceedingly difficult issues. What Act 10 did was it privatized the charter school system as well. Nationwide, the research on non-instrumentality charter schools is bad. They do not address the needs of children. They address the specific needs of adults and the profit needs of corporations. When it comes to virtual schools, there are some very, very good online programs, but when you're dealing with elementary and early secondary age children, the research shows what you need more than anything else is the relationship with caring and responsible and educated, licensed adults to lead them through a program that matters. Online options can help, but blended learning is how we get there. We don't have to do education the way we always have, but you cannot abandon a basic relationship between adults that teach children how learning is supposed to take place and the very reason it's important. That's why the commitment to public schools still is a basic for our government and for our state.
One final thing onto this one, because this is so, I think this is so vital. When we talk about public education, and when we talk about this struggle with things like distance learning, which I think is the most evil thing I've ever heard. I mean, and Mary's much more generous with distance learning than I am, because this is really, one of the fundamental things the progressives did when they came to power in this state 120 years ago, was that they took money that was concentrated in Milwaukee and Madison, and they spread it out to every small town in Wisconsin so it could build a school, so it could develop its services, and it could develop its infrastructure. And if you drive through western Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin, you do not find dusty, empty towns that are just blown away, as you do find when you're out in North Dakota and in states to the west. You find it in other places, but you do not find it here because we invested in all of these little towns. And what did we give them? We gave them a school. And that school became, and I'm all for educating the kids, I think that's a great idea. But I like the school as a center of a community, something we build everything we know and value around. And what at this moment are the proponents of an austerity agenda coming after in America? They are coming after public education, and they are saying in these small towns, well, you know, you can't support that little school, but it's okay. We can put your kid in front of a computer, and they can do distance learning. That'll work. And then the next is, we're going to close the school down, and then up in Washington, we're going to close the post office as well. And we are going to take the small towns of America, the kind of places where I grew up and where I'll bet a lot of you grew up, and we're going to say, there's no school anymore, there's no post office anymore, and those towns are going to dry up and disappear. We are going to effectively do what you see in a country like Mexico. You see in countries all over the world where the small towns have so little that everybody flees to the cities, and you have all the crises that go with that. That's the fundamental fight I care about. I care about education immensely, but I care even more about the deconstruction of our critical institutions and our communities across this state. And the one thing that a small town and an inner city has in common is a decent public school. If we take apart public education as a bricks and mortar physical reality, we will take apart our inner cities and our small towns, and we will make this a state of empty, soulless suburbia that is not worthy of its name. So I want to fight for public education because I want to keep every single school in this state open. I want to keep every post office open, and I want to maintain the whole.
I want to thank each of our panelists for coming tonight and giving us the benefit of their views. And I thank each of every one of you for coming. And I think we have some booksellers here with some of John's books. And you can stay for a few minutes.
Okay, so I just want to say hi to all these people I know and love.
Thank you all for coming. You can visit our website, themadisoninstitute.org, to keep up with what we're doing and our future programs. And please, on your way out, look for the blue baskets. If you have an envelope, put something in it, leave it in the basket for us. Help us continue to do this work of spreading progressive ideas and analysis about current